This episode of The Big Interview was first broadcast on the 17th of January 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24, our one-on-one show where people with fascinating lives, enviable careers, and plenty of great tales sit down and tell us how they got to where they are today, what inspires them, and what makes them tick. My guest today is Anthony Scher, the classical actor, writer, and artist who has played just about every male lead role there is to play in more than three decades at the Royal Shakespeare Company. Born in South Africa in 1949, he moved to London in 1968. Jewish, gay, and a white South African, he struggled with his identity, but threw himself into theatre, eventually joining the RSC in 1982. It was there that he met Gregory Doran, his partner for almost 30 years. With Doran recently installed as the RSC's artistic director, they're now British theatre's most influential couple. Scher is more than just an actor. He writes, he paints, and has tried to use his influence to campaign for gay rights around the world. And he joins me now. Anthony Scher, welcome to Monocle 24.
Thank you.
Can we begin as close to the beginning as possible, really? And can we go back to South Africa and your childhood? What sort of childhood did you have?
I think I had a very sort of ordinary childhood among the white people. Of course, this was apartheid South Africa, so you have to specify that. Important to say that my family, my parents weren't at all politically aware, which meant that I pretty much grew up in the middle of the atrocity that was apartheid, without really noticing it, which sounds a terrible thing to say now, but is the truth, that if you wanted to, as white people in South Africa in the 50s and 60s, when I was growing up, you could just have a very good life and really not know what was going on around you. It's extraordinary. I mean, the beaches of Sea Point, Cape Town, where I'm from, they overlook Robben Island. Robben Island is clearly visible. And I swear to you, we didn't know, we probably didn't even know it was a prison island, never mind what was going on. And so when I came to England in 1968, I got a very big shock when I could be exposed to the reality of South Africa through British press, TV, and so on.
Was there a single moment where you twigged, or was it a gradual process?
I think it was a gradual process. Remember, there'd been very strong government censorship in South Africa, newspapers and radio, and we didn't have television in South Africa then. So the government very much controlled what we were thinking. So when I came here, it was gradual and then became, I sort of went into a state of shock, really. Because the irony is that my grandparents, my parents' parents, had fled prejudice in Eastern Europe as Jews. They'd fled from Lithuania round about 1900 because of the pogroms that were heading their way. And so they very much knew what it was like to be second-class citizens, to be despised. But they went to South Africa, they did well, and somehow never drew the comparison. It's, again, hard to believe, but it's kind of quite human.
I want to come back to South Africa in a moment, but first of all, let's talk about your arrival in London. You arrived Jewish, white South African, also gay, at a time when, let's face it, the situation for young gay men in London was very different from how it is now.
Well, I arrived in 68, and the Wolfenden Report which decriminalised homosexuality, had only been a year before, 67. But I was also in a very confused state sexually. I knew I was gay. Deep down I knew that, but I didn't want to be. Obviously, I'd grown up in a very conservative, oppressive society in terms of human freedoms. So for quite a few years, I tried to be straight and indeed had several relationships with women. Before finally I just said, oh, this is ridiculous. I'm not being what I am. How can I be an actor if I'm not going to first be myself? You know, so in a way I had to come out not only as gay, but as white South African, because I had disguised that.
Had you changed your accent?
Yes. I became so ashamed of white South Africa when I learnt the truth. And Jewish, I didn't often admit to that because I couldn't see many examples of Jewish actors, you know, who'd done well, say, in classical theatre, which is where my career ended up going. So I had a lot of closets to come out. I'm very pleased to say I'm now out of them all and celebrate who I am, because that is who I am, and it's a rich thing if you can just not fear the things that society says is wrong with you and gradually just learn to celebrate your individuality.
I'm intrigued by the accent, by changing an accent. Was that a decision, or was that something you just sort of slipped into?
Well, it was partly to do with being at drama school and having to learn to speak what's called RP. But I had started to lose it before drama school, because I honestly thought that if people in England knew that I was white South African, they'd punch me. You know, I really went through a period of feeling very, very ashamed of my people.
In terms of the start of your career then, did you find it a lot harder because you had all these issues to do with your identity whirling away in the background for you to really sort of throw yourself into, you know, taking on someone else's identity on stage?
Well, I think the solution for me was character acting. Just to be clear, I think there's kind of two kinds of acting. One is not better than the other, but there's personality acting, where the actor takes the character and makes the character into them. If you think of some of the Hollywood classic film stars, James Stewart, you know, terrific actor, but always James Stewart, no transformation whatsoever, which is fine. Then there's the character actor who moves away from themselves to the character to become someone totally different. And the best example of that is Meryl Streep. Extraordinary transformations. So at first for me, this was the solution. I would heavily disguise myself in every part I played, with makeup, with accents, with padding, with whatever. And it's taken me quite a long time to realize that disguise is not the secret of good acting. What Meryl Streep does is, yes, she does transform herself, but you always feel her heart and soul in those performances. So she might be playing Maggie Thatcher, but there will be something shining out of her that is Meryl Streep's own soul. That is, for me, the greatest acting. That is what I kind of aspire to now.
You're best known for being a Shakespearean actor. Is that fair?
Yes. Oh, I'd say classical, because I've done quite a few of Shakespeare's contemporaries while I've been at the Royal Shakespeare Company as well.
And what is it that has drawn you towards classical acting?
Well, you know, I'm not quite sure. If somebody had told me as a kid, or even as a student, you know, coming over here to study drama, that I would end up as a classical actor, I would have found it hard to believe. When you're starting out as an actor, you'll really do anything that comes along because, as you know, the unemployment is very, very high. And I had grown up with the idea of the great classical actors. You know, while I was growing up, Laurence Olivier, John Gielgud, Michael Redgrave, Ralph Richardson, they were a particular type of tall, handsome, British men. I just couldn't see how me being quite short, dark, Jewish could ever go that way. But I went to the RSC in 1982 first, and I was just lucky that at that time there were some great teachers there. John Barton, who is also a considerable director, but he teaches Shakespeare, so we would used to have these workshops in Stratford where we would be taught about speaking Shakespeare. There was Sis Berry as well, the RSC's great voice guru. And then, quite soon after I joined, Terry Hands became artistic director. And he saw in me potential as a classical actor, which I hadn't seen myself, and kind of took it upon himself to nurture me into becoming a classical actor. So I've just been incredibly lucky right until recently, because my partner, Greg Doran, who actually we're now married, is of course the artistic director now. And we've been together for 29 years, and his passion is Shakespeare. I mean, absolutely lives and breathes it. So, I mean, how lucky am I that I'm actually married to a great Shakespearean now? You know, it's all sort of been part of a pattern that I would never have anticipated.
You've just mentioned lots of different people, and you've talked about how lucky you've been and all these opportunities. Do you think you're good at what you do?
Well, of course, that's not for me to say.
Why not?
Well, because I wouldn't be able to say that, but I guess I've done well enough for other people to be saying that I'm good at what I do. I couldn't have fooled everyone all the time, so something must have worked right.
Well, let me put it this way then. Do you feel comfortable taking to the stage in the RSC and feel that this is somewhere where you belong?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's completely home now. But as I say, I joined in 82, so what's that? It's over 30 years or whatever.
It's a while, yeah.
It's a while. And most of, quite a large majority of my career has been there. So it's very much home, yes.
You also write, and you also you're also an artist.
Yeah.
What is it that drives you, that when you get up in the morning, leads you to want to create something?
Well, I'm a workaholic. I seriously love work. Those three things that I do: acting, writing, and painting. I'm really a bit lost if I'm not doing one of them. It's a source of enormous nourishment to me.
Do you feel they all feed into each other?
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, for example, with painting, I can only do portraiture. I can't do landscapes. And portraiture is, of course, what I'm doing as an actor as well. I'm portraying other people. Writing is different, but, well, I just love it. Of the three, I guess, it's the one that I just love most, because I can lose myself for hours, days, months in a book.
We're living in a time, particularly in the West, where the arts is struggling for funding, is often seen as not quite as important at school as other subjects. Does that worry you?
It does, because people underestimate what the arts are, the wealth that they are, how culture is one of the richest things any country has. If you think of Shakespeare, and of course this year is the 400th anniversary of his death, I mean, what an amazing cultural richness this country has in Shakespeare, which is exported around the world. What a wonderful, extraordinary thing. And every country has their great artists. I mean, I've seen this argument particularly in the new South Africa, where they could argue strongly that it was more important to get hospitals and schools in place to repair the damage that apartheid had done, that was more important than funding theatres. But I still argued against them there that they must not lose the great, great cultural traditions they have there, because a country without culture is the poorer for it.
What is a young person missing out on if they haven't been exposed to theatre?
Well, I mean, imagine not knowing Shakespeare. Imagine not having that exposure. I mean, Shakespeare is a remarkable genius who portrays humanity in every single aspect. It's 360 degrees, his view of humanity. And you learn so much, you find out so much about yourself and the world through seeing Shakespeare, or in my case, if you're lucky enough to do Shakespeare. Imagine if you didn't have that in your life. Wouldn't that be a massive loss, a massive gap? I think so.
And so then for someone like you who believes that, living in a country where we are right now in the UK, where arts funding is being cut, where there are schools where art and music and drama simply aren't being taught, what can you do to change that?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that, because the RSC has started something which I'm sure you've heard of called Live from Stratford, where productions are filmed in performance and then sent, you can see them in cinemas and around the world and in this country. But importantly, as part of that same thing, we stream them live into schools. So a school that had no drama department left or whatever, and perhaps would be unable to travel to Stratford and see us perform, they will get those productions streamed into their schools. And we're having fantastic reports from the teachers about the effect that's having on kids. So that's something we can do and are doing.
In terms of the state of theatre at the moment, we can maybe talk a little about the rest of the world at the moment, but in the UK, it's, aside from the funding crisis, it is, let's face it, very white, very middle class, and very male.
Not so much male anymore. If you looked at the RSC's recent productions, there have been a host of female directors. I wish I could reel off the names in the productions, but honestly, check it out. There have been an enormous amount of female directors at the RSC just in the last 2 years.
But still very white and still white. Overwhelmingly middle class.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of white, in terms of casting, you probably know that we have a policy of colour-blind casting, so black actors will play parts that were traditionally white. We're about to have a black Hamlet at the RSC in Stratford. But the audiences will still tend to be pretty white and pretty middle class. Yeah, that's another boundary to be crossed.
You went back to South Africa after the end of apartheid and took Titus Andronicus to the Market Theatre in Johannesburg. How different was that experience from your normal Shakespeare's done at the RSC or done down in London?
Well, first of all, I didn't take it there. The Market Theatre created it with me and with Greg directing. It was a co-production with the National Theatre in London with their studio. So the attempt was to feed into the Market Theatre some of our knowledge and experience of Shakespeare. But it was an entirely South African cast and South African musicians and designer. And a part of this experiment, if you want to call it that, was to do the play in South African accents, in the full range of white and black South African accents, because Greg and I thought that the language sounded terrific, because Shakespeare really does sound good with kind of muscular, rough, tough accents, so that you can bring out that muscularity and in that play the violence of his language. So from our point of view, this was tremendously exciting, and I'm very, very proud of what we produced. South African audiences were less impressed by it.
Really?
Well, they had, at that time, it may be different now, because it was done in, about 94, I think. They had a rather old-fashioned idea that Shakespeare had to sound posh, English posh, not, you know, that's again how they were brought up, like I'd been brought up. So they wanted us all to sound like Prince Charles.
Was this predominantly white South African audiences or black South African audiences?
It was a mixture, because the Market, as you know, was very much a multiracial theatre, even under apartheid. But so we were getting quite negative responses about... I remember one South African lady saying, I don't want to come to see Shakespeare and hear him spoken in an ugly South African accent. This was a woman who spoke in a South African accent. Anyway, so we had quite a bumpy ride while it was there, and then we brought it to the National and to the West Yorkshire Playhouse, where it was greatly applauded. Because in this country, people are more used to different experiments and different things being done with Shakespeare. Barry Rutter's company, Northern Broadsides, only does Shakespeare in Northern accents. And, you know, for a similar reason, that he loves the muscularity that those Northern accents bring to Shakespeare's language.
Do you feel that this fight is your fight as well? Do you still feel that South Africa is your nation and you want to be a part of building the new South Africa?
Well, as much as I can. My life is so much here. I don't think that I could properly say that I can fight the South African fight as much as if I was living there. But it's certainly something that I look at with concern and watch with concern and feel, you know, whenever we go there. It's something that I'm very aware of, sort of feeling how the country is, how it's doing, with always the hope that it will come right completely. But it's surely going to take generations of clearing that poison. You know, apartheid was like a poison in a body, and it's not been all cleared out yet, and until it is, South Africa will not be a totally healthy place.
Talking more broadly, are there issues that make you angry that would bring you out onto the streets to protest?
In South Africa?
In Britain, in South Africa, anywhere in the world. Are there things that burn you up inside, you think something has to be done and I'd be happy to play a part?
Well, homophobia in places like Uganda, Russia, the Middle East, I get terribly upset about that. As I mentioned, Greg and I were able to get married about 10 days ago. And I thought, what an astonishing thing to have gone from the South Africa where I was brought up in, where homosexuality was illegal, to being able to get married. And at the same time as celebrating that, I thought, but there are places in the world where gay men are thrown off high buildings, where they are stoned, where they are hanged from cranes. We are incredibly fortunate that this country is as civilized as it is. But there are places in the world where gay rights and human rights are not observed, and I get very, very upset about that.
It's interesting that in almost every interview I've read of yours or I've seen of yours, you mention Greg. And of course, most people will sort of mention their wife or husband or partner in interviews. But is it also a sort of a more deliberate act from you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, for example, for many years I wrote travel pieces for the Sunday Times and the Guardian. I would always make a point of mentioning that I'm travelling with my partner, Greg. It was just our way of doing what eventually will happen, which is making it ordinary. So, you know, it would just be mentioned casually in the article. There would be no big deal about it, just so that it was ordinary. And I think you can see that happening in this country, where it is becoming more ordinary. Friends of mine that have kids at school, they say those kids don't make a great deal of it anymore. So hopefully things are really progressing very well in this country. As I say, not in all the countries of the world.
Just finally, do you have any big burning ambitions left? Were you a man who had big burning ambitions in the first place?
Well, I had a Jewish mother, so that automatically means that...
So she had ambitions for you, but did you have them for yourself?
Well, it's catching that degree of ambitiousness that she had. A small example, when I got my knighthood, I rang her in South Africa and said, "Mum, I've got a knighthood." And she went, "Oh, so maybe you'll be a lord one day." The very moment of my what felt like triumph, it wasn't good enough.
There's still another mountain to climb.
So I guess, yes, I was pretty ambitious as a young actor. I'm not now, having become a classical actor. I'm going to play King Lear this year, and that's really... the parts have run out with that. So I'm not quite sure what I've got to be ambitious about anymore. You know, it's I'm very, very lucky to have had the career I've had.
Anthony Scher, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Steve Bloomfield, in conversation with Anthony Scher. The Big Interview is produced and edited by Bill Luty and researched by Guy Lutz. Don't forget to subscribe to this and any of our other programmes on Monocle 24. They can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, or of course, monocle.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.